Foremost in the minds of most citizens today is the question of what exactly the Russian atomic bomb will mean to America. This evening from Akron, Ohio, CBS brings you a talk by General Omar N. Bradley, Chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who recently returned from a tour of our Alaskan defenses. General Bradley's speech, as recorded earlier this evening at a banquet in the Mayflower Hotel in connection with the 68th annual meeting of the American Forestry Association, is entitled, What the Russian Atomic Bomb Means to the American People. General Bradley.
The world today stands almost transfixed in awe of the tiny but powerful atom. Its power to destroy overshadows, never mind, its power for helplessness. So long as we alone held the atomic weapon, we could be sure that no atomic bomb would start another war. Hoping to turn its power to peaceful gain, we offered it to international control. We used its silent threat to deter any quick aggression, and we used the breathing time for peaceful reconstruction. Just as we knew that Soviet scientists soon would solve the atomic riddle, so did we realize that on Red Atom Day, a new phase of our struggle for peace would begin. As calmly as they have taken the pronouncement of that discovery, Americans and their friends await further information on our collective security plans. Although defense problems cannot be entirely solved by spending, I do believe that we must now review our rate of spending for certain previously planned installations and developments of our national security establishment. For Russia's atomic explosion takes its earliest effect on our defense pocketbook. Facing the awesome possibility of a war at some indefinite time in the future, and knowing that we cannot tell exactly when that sometime might be, we realize that we cannot maintain sufficient armed forces and modern weapons to provide absolute security. On the other hand, we have the comforting knowledge that the United States of America and its newly allied friends of the Atlantic Pact will never start a war for any purpose. This increases the possibility of having no war at all. However, facing all the international facts of life, you realize that there is a large land-based power in the world today that might start a war. Whether motivated by misplaced fear of attack or by schemes of aggression, Russia has maintained an army of 2.5 million men. Her Air Force numbers over 600,000 men, with somewhere between 14 and 16,000 aircraft. And adapting German submarine models, she has developed a very modern undersea force. Since VE Day, she has devoted a large percentage of her industrial capacity to the maintenance and modernization of her armed forces. And 2 weeks ago, it was revealed that the Soviet Union, the only possible enemy in sight for the next 20 years, had thrown into the balance its newfound mastery of the atom. Keenly aware of our position, Americans have not been living a grasshopper summer to be confronted now with a chill of unpreparedness. Our own army, allotted 33.6% of the security dollar, has been steadily rebuilding while carrying on the occupation duties to which it is assigned. The Air Force, given 34 cents of each defense dollar, has progressed steadily in size and ability. And the Navy, allotted for the present fiscal year 32.4 cents of a defense dollar, stands second to none in the world. Hence, you will see that our three services have approximately equal shares of our defense dollar. The American people realize that the first prize for any aggressor in the world today might be Europe, with its industrial potential and its market for goods. So they have reaffirmed in economic aid and by political tie that the Western Europe, which we have twice defended, is linked with this continent in peace and for protection. The President last week signed a military assistance program to speed up the military rehabilitation of those nations whose ideological and security interests are held in common with our own. The basic defense principle of the North Atlantic Treaty and of the military aid program is that each nation shall contribute those things which it can best provide in the collective security plan. And in dividing our own defense dollar in future years, it is this same principle which must override wishful adherence to prestige, time-honored tradition, or biased enthusiasm for any one of our armed forces as we contribute our share. To gain maximum safety at the least expense, the Joint Chiefs of Staff must give very careful consideration to those items which constitute the basic necessities. First priority must provide those forces which can avert disaster in the event that war is thrust upon us and our friends. To impress the aggressor that a bully's blow can't escape the sting of reprisal, we must possess the means to retaliate quickly and hard. And finally, knowing well that blows once exchanged do not subside until one or the other is victor, we must provide the means necessary for the mobilization of our manpower and other resources which can eventually carry the war back to the enemy to his ultimate defeat. These are the priorities which have governed our plan so far. Now, with certain knowledge that atomic weapons, by plane or by missile, could be used against us eventually, we must choose carefully the further armaments of defense. Your President, your Secretary of Defense, and your military counselors have assured you that this calls for no change in basic defense plans. When we ourselves have leaned so heavily on our monopoly of the atomic bomb as a deterrent for war, it is natural for Americans to doubt this statement. These assurances are sound, and I will explain the merit of their meaning. The Joint Chiefs of Staff have anticipated that the Russians would, sometime, solve the problem of atomic weapons. We have pointed out that in the second phase of the atomic problem, America and her friends will have a continued respite from attack because of the preponderance of our stockpile of atomic bombs and our lead in men and planes to deliver bombs on any aggressor. That phase exists today. How long this condition will exist, no one knows. Estimates in our staff on when the Russians would have the atomic bomb ranged from 1950 to 1952. Their atomic explosion preceded the earliest of these estimates by several months. Estimates have also been made of the time from this first announcement until the Russians could have enough atomic weapons in quantity to influence the outcome of a modern war. They could be foolhardy enough to launch an atomic attack with only a handful of atomic bombs. But of all the people on this earth, they are students of force and of power in war, and should understand clearly the disastrous result of such a gruesome error. But military men must be realists. You depend on them to be prepared. We have worked out an orderly timetable of preparation for atomic defense. Like a plan for mobilization in case of attack, it was tied to a day in the future on which a specific event should come to pass. That day has now arrived, Red Atom Day. And our program to provide for defense in this second phase is already well underway. Further realizing that when this A Day arrived, our economy could not stand the immediate expenditure of all the monies necessary to provide for the atomic defense of this continent, our timetable calls for the spending, for the spreading out of these expenditures in an orderly progression over a period of years. The people in the Congress will be asked to provide for those items essential to the orderly implementation of these security measures. If our plea for the international control of atomic energy is heeded, any attempt to overrun Europe will first touch the point of Allied bayonets in Germany. If this becomes the case, then the Army must be ready to repel a land assault with sufficient tactical air power to gain and maintain local superiority over Red bombers and fighters. If our pleas for control of atomic energy are not met with honest agreement, then the blow may strike at the heart of industrial America. If that is the case, we may have to invest our funds in anti-aircraft guided missiles, necessary radar screen for Canada and the United States in the Arctic, and the necessary fighter interceptor squadrons to dispel long-range bombardment attack. In either situation, our Navy must maintain control of the seas. It possesses that power of control today. Our collective defensive frontiers in the heart of Europe need the support of American industry and arms. We must deny any aggressor close bases for attack against this gun. Within this pattern of security, the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force have been assigned roles and responsibilities. Their leaders are responsible and earnest men, each seeking to carry out his mission at maximum efficiency. Naturally, each proponent of this service will seek as great a percentage of the defense dollar as he can get. Estimating the total problem and then turning to his specific task, he realizes that there will never be enough money to go around. Defense-wise, he is dealing in dollar deficits. The American people have decided that they can get the maximum security out of each dollar through a united effort and have so organized the Department of Defense. Encouraged by the great accomplishment of teamwork from earliest colonial times to the latest developments in modern industry, Americans are convinced that efficiency and accomplishment go hand in hand with teamwork. Within this organization, we of the Joint Chiefs of Staff hope to provide relative security within decreasing defense appropriations. It is not going to be easy. In the complexity of defense planning, the division of the defense dollar undoubtedly will continue to be a very serious bone of contention among the services. With the unification machinery only 2 years old, you can hardly expect earnest and sincere citizens faced with the grave responsibility of protecting our people with fewer funds than are considered necessary to agree on budget division. I believe the American people would not want it otherwise, for in this spirit of competition is born the close examination of expenditures that assures no waste and maximum security. And finally, when the President and the Secretary of Defense have made the decision of the defense budget, then each service must carry its fair share of our calculated risk. The people of the United States have twice affirmed through their elected representatives that the maximum security at least cost can be provided through unity in planning and command. And the Congress has recently pointed out that our defense plans must be closely related to those of our allies if funds are to be granted. I firmly believe that unity of effort, both nationally and internationally, can produce the greatest security for all of us, that unity of effort and common ideal to humanity can negate the red atom, and that ultimately Americans shall lead the way steadfastly to a lesser possibility of war for our children and the world we are building for the future.
From Akron, Ohio, you have heard a talk by General Omar N. Bradley, Chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, on what the Russian atomic bomb means to the American people. His speech, as recorded earlier this evening, was in connection with the 68th annual meeting of the American Forestry Association.